The following episode of the 9 PM Edict is important. Every single piece of information is vital to our national security. You must help protect our way of life. Listen closely and observe all safety precautions. It contains strong language.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
Sunday, the 1st of February 2015. It's so long since the last episode, we've already celebrated the birthday of gentle baby Jesus.
Jesus would tell that God-fearing, red-blooded American sniper, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," for dispatching another godless jihadist to the lake of fire.
It's 2015, a brand new year with the same old crusader rabbit.
Let us rededicate ourselves to building a better Australia with more opportunity for everyone. Happy New Year, Australia.
This is the 9 PM. I can't believe it's not January. No, it is not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. It's not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. It is not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. It is not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. It is not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. Yes. Yes, all right. Yes. I understand. I understand. It is not January. There are no Christmas Nazis. I am instructed to explain why it's 1.5 months since the last episode of this podcast. I can confirm that in early January, I ended up spending 47 hours working on stressful and unexpected work at all manner of inconvenient times. I can confirm that I obtained insufficient sleep during that period. I can confirm that this adversely affected my health, both physical and mental. I can confirm extensive periods of code Bristol 7. I can confirm that in my exhaustion, I spent days on end catching up on SBS television programs through SBS On Demand on the internet. I can confirm that every 10 minutes, they played the same advertisement for Chill.
Unwind with Chill. A relaxing collection of global tracks as heard on SBS Chill. Now available at ABC shops, Dimix, retailers, and on iTunes.
Yes, I can confirm that they played it every 10 minutes.
Unwind with Chill.
I can confirm that I have absolutely no idea what global tracks are.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that I have an overpowering urge to wear white lint. Do I have to read this? I can confirm that I have an overpowering urge to wear white linen and decorate my home in a minimalist manner.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that it is much windier since all the wind turbines were switched on, and that there is more dust.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that the Australian government's attempts to reform the health system without any wasteful thinking and analysis was a brilliant move, and I'm disappointed that it failed.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that I have fallen in love with Professor David Flint. I am not entirely sure when this began. It kind of happened gradually. But Professor David Flint is my inspiration and guide, and he should also be yours.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that a broom handle is the length it is for a reason, even if at first it is uncomfortable or even painful.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm what I heard in a radio advertisement, namely that if you want to look good up top, don't buy your bra from a regular shop. Make a note of that. I did, and I do not regret it.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that I was an accessory after the fact to the commission of obscene acts upon an octopus.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that I wish to buy an expensive European car and fit it with customized number plates in the color of my choice.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I can confirm that my deepest desire is to create a content marketing strategy to amplify my personal brand.
Unwind with Chill.
I am Unwind with Chill. I am Stilgherrian. I can confirm that welcome to the edict. I can confirm that none of this ever happened.
January, sitting on your penis near me. A little bit more.
Well, it's been a while, hasn't it? Which is a shame, I know, but I must say that every day when diarrhea prevented me from tracking the news cycle so closely was really a blessing from God. And really, over the last 6 or 7 weeks, nothing much has changed. I mean, Crusader Rabbit is still the most unpopular Prime Minister of Australia in 235 years. And as I record this on Sunday night, the 1st of February, the Queensland state election, which was held yesterday, looks like it'll deliver a Labor government, a complete landslide. And the Rabster, well, he's responding by still being a parrot, a kind of furry, hoppy parrot, I suppose. But in a press conference today, he tried running a fascinating piece of logic past us that the Queensland election was all about state issues, not federal issues, but that nevertheless, at the federal level, they'd be learning the lessons.
How much blame do you take, Mr. Abbott, for the Queensland election result?
Well, it's interesting. I saw some of the leaders' debate. I saw some of the People's Forum. And no federal issues were raised. So
The knighthood effect must have had an impact, mustn't it?
Well, it was a distraction for a couple of days. I accept that, and I very much regret that. But in the end, the voters of Australia are pretty smart. They judge state elections on state issues, and they judge federal elections on federal issues. And as I say, Campbell was a good premier. He ran a good government, but there are obviously lessons in the election result last night, and we're determined to learn them in Canberra.
And when Abbott was asked straight up what he was going to change about the way he runs his decision-making, he didn't even come close to answering the question. He just bleated a few slogans, most of them old slogans, along with, you know, the usual dollop of blame for Labor.
What process are you going to implement now to make sure that you have better judgment in the future?
Well, as I said, we are doing what we were elected
to do. And I have to say,
it's not very popular, so wouldn't the government have to try and do something different?
Well, what we're doing is we are building a strong and prosperous economy for a safe and secure Australia. I accept that there have been some difficult times. I absolutely accept that. And obviously we've had some difficulties in the Senate. But we have listened, we have learned. We will be a more consultative and collegial government in 2015 than we were in 2014. We will not take the Senate for granted in 2015, as perhaps sometimes we were tempted to do in 2014. But the important thing is not to navel gaze. It's not to focus on ourselves. The important thing is to get on with the job of being a better government today than we were yesterday, being a better government tomorrow than we are today. That's the constant challenge of government.
Oh, he didn't say it in that bit. I better include the famous phrase.
Well, as I said, the people of Australia elected me as Prime Minister, and they elected my government to get on with the job of governing our country, to clean up Labor's mess.
And there you have it, really. Tony Abbott, Australia's janitor-in-chief. That's his vision right there. Some sort of, oh, I can't do the metaphor now because it's kind of a rabbit parrot garbage collector and it all gets a bit too complicated. In the break, some dull political tribalist referred to me as a hater because I criticise Abbott. That's the extent of their reasoning. I don't like Abbott because I'm a hater, which is stupid for three reasons, really. One is that it's pretty dumb not to notice that I'm an equal opportunity critic, that I dole out my negative thoughts pretty much regardless of political party. Secondly, hater, and calling me a hater, that's just the logical fallacy of name-calling. It's a pretty dumb rhetorical trick that gets the logic backwards. If someone hates a public figure, it's for a reason. To say that, oh, well, you just don't like them because you're a hater, that's almost a tautology, isn't it? And it's kind of, as I say, a cheap rhetorical trick. The idea is that you kind of smother over the idea that there might actually be a reason for this dislike. And let's face it, with Tony Abbott, there's plenty of reasons to choose from. And thirdly, it's not actually hate, you fucktard. It's laughter. I mean, it's despair. For fuck's sake, some of us lived through the era when the likes of Tony Abbott were in student politics. We laughed then and we laughed now. And I'll have to make it clear again, it's not party political. The jokers on the other side provide just as much mirth. What I find hilarious is that there are politicians of Tony Abbott's era still fighting the same tedious factional battles that they were fighting in the 1970s with the same kind of pretty dull basic ideology underlying it. I mean, can you imagine not actually moving on in your thought in the intervening decades, 30, even 40 years? Jesus, Tony, some of us have actually learned stuff and moved on in those decades, you poor pathetic cunt. And do you remember Tony Abbott's pre-Christmas sulk? Oh, why don't you like me? I did okay with MH17. Well, that's just the routine shit of being Prime Minister and dealing with what comes up and not being a dork. The PM's job is to do that, but it's also leadership. No, it's not hate. If only Tony Abbott were worthy of the effort of hate. I mean, the emotions, as I say, that I have about Tony Abbott are pity and despair. Pity for the man living in the shallowness of his own mind and despair for us. I mean, Tony Abbott, as Prime Minister of Australia, can't even stand up in front of a TV camera and speak without a hand up his ass. He's a man who craved power so much and is so desperate to hold on to it, and yet he actually has no fucking idea what to do with it when he's got it. He just wants to win. And now that he's won, he doesn't want to lose. Tony Abbott, who sketched this out? One of the political commentators, that he's really a sycophant, that he'll say whatever he thinks will most please the person standing in front of him. And that's pathetic. As in pathos, you know? Here is a man even less worldly and steadfast in his convictions than Mr. Suburbia himself, John Howard. Wow. It's no wonder that Tony Abbott is out there on a bicycle so often going very fast, because it's an achievement that fits his intellectual grasp, isn't it? Now, I don't hate Tony Abbott. I just laugh and 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 laugh. There he is. He's in the big office. Tony, you've done it. You've scored the pension now. Well done. Pass on the little crown to someone in a way that saves a bit of face, and just fuck off. I can throw a final punch in this little spiel. Imagine that Tony Abbott has a preferred prime minister score that's even less than Bill Shorten's. I mean, really? That fact alone, Tony Abbott, I don't know how you go through each day without asking your bodyguard if you could just borrow their Glock and be left alone for a few minutes. Still, better than actually being Bill Shorten, isn't it? Yes. Keep up the good work, comrade. What if Hitler were made of cheese?
Constipated panda.
Oh, that's right. Do you remember the other day there was the headline, UK government could ban encrypted communications with new surveillance powers? Yes, the British Prime Minister David Cameron just thought, oh, we can't have encrypted communication because terrorists can communicate in secret. Yes, in further news, the UK government announces that it'll, I don't know, ban cardboard boxes and Hessian sacks because you can't see what's inside them. I mean, let's be real here. Whenever there is a thing that you can't see inside, it might have terrorism inside it, so you must ban it. You are not permitted to have a thing that might have another thing inside it because terrorism. You idiots. Instead of "it might have terrorism in it," maybe the first thought that should come into our minds is, you know, pretty much with any object, it is extremely unlikely that it has anything to do with terrorism in it. It's this bizarre, paranoid approach to the world. And what makes it particularly wrong is that, well, just stop to think a moment about what it means for how you approach society. Cameron has basically straight up said that, quote, you know, "the spooks must be able to read it," is the key framing issue for structuring society. Now, I don't say the words police state very often, but isn't that kind of like the definition that the primary framing issue is for the police? I've kind of been, since that happened, I've been shaking my head in a mixture of pity and wry laughter at the, quote, wisdom, unquote, of David Cameron's vision for the world. But then I suppose, you know, it is an election year in the UK. That whole fear protector, strong daddy, come to daddy. I'm your daddy. My name is David. I mean, that whole process is rolling out, right? It's just shut the fuck up and be afraid of all the things, and I will protect you from them. You know, some mornings, I mean, you just know that by the end of the day, you'll inevitably end up masturbating to photographs of David Cameron. And since this announcement, I've been there. I mean, David Cameron, along with Australia's Attorney General, Soapy the Ankle QC, George Brandis to you plebs, I've been imagining David Cameron and George Brandis having very special pillow talk about the evils of encryption and police brutality. It's kind of a whole David Cameron, George Brandis, rough, dirty sex, visual imagery rabbit hole that I have been a long way down over the past few days. And I mean, down that rabbit hole, I have visualized this kind of Cameron Brandis slash fiction in vast and graphic fucking detail, and I tell you what, it is good. It is so good. I have never felt this good before. The other thing to consider, of course, is that this whole, oh, we need more powers thing from the spooks is, well, that's just letting the spooks avoid having to think about whether they competently use the powers they already have. I mean, we've had, what, in Australia, 60-odd pieces of legislation since 9/11 giving the spooks and law enforcement agencies more power. It's always more power. There's never the question of, well, hang on, you've got lots of power already. And quite frankly, when the spooks already have the legal power to pretty much walk through fucking walls, the bad thing happening, whether we're talking about Charlie Hebdo in France or, I don't know, Martin Place siege, they called it. One bloke is a siege in Sydney. You know, when there's so much legal power in the spooks' hands already, the bad thing happening probably isn't down to lack of power. And yet, this kind of issue never gets brought up in conversation. I mean, when was it? Thursday this week was another hearing of Australia's Joint Parliamentary Committee on Intelligence and Security, and Philip Ruddock MP, who's kind of like a, oh, how do you describe Philip Ruddock for people who aren't Australian? He's the undead, basically. This is a verbatim question from Philip Ruddock MP, who is a member and has been a member for some time of Australia's Joint Parliamentary Committee on Intelligence and Security. Skype, that's a telephone that you use on a computer? Yes, fellow Australians, one of the politicians deciding how much will be surveilled in the digital future is approaching Skype, which is used by grandparents everywhere, as a complete mystery. Yes, people who don't even know what Skype is, let alone how it works, are discussing the legal framework under which surveillance of Skype and other digital tools will happen. These are people whose job it is to understand the world and legislate for its future, and they can't even be asked to bother to fucking find out the basics of it. I mean, in a more civilized age, these people would be...
Comments deleted in consideration of Section 474 of the Criminal Code Act 1995.
Warning to others. We've had the internet longer than we've had GST. Any politician who couldn't explain the goods and services tax would quite rightly be crucified, and yet we let this happen with other more fundamental structural issues about our modern society. And if you wish to infer from that, then I'm calling for the crucifixion of federal MPs, or yeah, fuck.
Comments most definitely deleted in consideration of Section 474 of the Criminal Code Act 1995.
Bleeding out all over the ground. And I wonder whether Philip Ruddock is interested, actually, in being anything other than a seat warmer now until his parliamentary pension kicks in. Here's the thing. I mean, Philip Ruddock is still there. He's still a member of parliament. He's still on committees. He's not putting in the effort to get it right. And yet he's still taking the salary. Isn't that kind of fraud? This kind of question goes to character, Philip Ruddock. It goes to character. This kind of raises the question, doesn't it? Why is Philip Ruddock even there? What purpose does he serve for himself, for his party, for Australia, for the fucking undead moon men? I don't know. I assume that the Liberal Party has Philip Ruddock in it for the same reason that ships have anchors, to kind of stop them drifting onto the rocks, and they're doing that quite nicely on their own volition, aren't they? Whether or not Philip Ruddock, it's part of it. Fascinating news story this week, too. The United States Federal Communication Commission, the FCC, has changed its definition of broadband. They're now saying that to call something broadband internet, it needs a minimum download speed of 25 megabits per second and a minimum upload speed of 3 megabits per second. To quote one of the commissioners, Mignon Kleiber, quote, "The broadband speeds of yesteryear are woefully inadequate today and beyond." And this is fascinating because it means that in one fell stroke, the FCC has basically said that, what is it, something like a third of the internet connections in the United States no longer count as broadband. AT&T, for example, their fastest DSL only reaches 6 megabit per second down. Verizon's DSL speed tops out at 15 meg, and that's not going to be increasing. So millions of DSL subscribers in the US are now deemed not to have broadband, which fuels, obviously, the whole policy thing of, well, you know, the government needs to ensure that people do have broadband and bump it up. It's a bold and gutsy move. It's a forward-looking move, and it shows to me really the strength of an independent communications commission like the FCC in the United States. Whereas in Australia, oh, how do we define broadband? Is it 25 megabits per second? No. Is it 4 megabits per second, which is the FCC's previous minimum download speed? No. No, boys and girls. As of June 2014, the last reporting period, the Australian Bureau of Statistics counts as broadband anything over 256 kilobits per second, a quarter of a megabit per second, a hundredth of the US figure. Mind you, that 256K figure is up from what the Australian definition used to be, which was 128K. In further news, the Australian government updates its definition of aircraft to include anything not actually hauled by an ox. Hello, I'm Stilgerian. Welcome to the Edict. If you've noticed a slight difference about the audio quality in this episode of The Edict, have a look at the illustration on the podcast webpage. You will see that my little Zoom H1 recorder has suffered a bit of a fatality. And so I'm actually recording this using the built-in microphone on my 4-year-old MacBook Pro. It's not completely shit. I'll have something improved by next episode. Speaking of not completely shit, John Birmingham. I had the pleasure recently of reading John Birmingham's new novel, Emergence. For those of you who don't know John Birmingham, look him up. He's written all sorts of wonderful books and is a columnist in the Brisbane Times. But his new novel, Emergence, in it, he creates a whole new universe of monsters and petrochemicals. The book begins with the sentence, "A helicopter is no place for a hangover," and goes downhill from there. Of course it does. And it's really a glorious blend of flawed, really corrupt characters in the petrochemical industry and elsewhere, in police and military, some seriously thick demons, and yes, I do mean demonic forces, who are stupid, and excessively violent combat scenes. I mean, utterly bloodthirsty stuff. That is to say, all this, it's yet another trashy thriller, just as we have come to expect from John Birmingham. We love him for it. 5 stars. Now, I mention this because now that I've read the book, I have no need to keep it. And so, therefore, I'm going to give it away. And in this little literary spot, I mean, I don't talk about literature much, but I think for what I consider to be the best audio comment that I receive for this podcast during February. So from now until the end of February, if you provide an audio comment for the podcast, I will consider it, and the one I think best will win you this copy of John Birmingham's Emergence. If you want to know more about it, go to the podcast website. There's a link to the book, etc., etc. And speaking of literature, I was intrigued the other day to see someone by the name of, by the handle at least, of Miktar, M-I-K-T-A-R, tweeting that his favourite author was Chuck Tingle. Now, I hadn't heard of Chuck Tingle before, but Miktar kindly included some book cover shots with the tweet. And I must admit, these titles do sound like they'd take some beating. Space Raptor Butt Invasion, with the cover illustrated with a kind of a generic shirtless American hunk boy being approached, shall we say, by a space lizard on a lunar Segway. Yes, I did just say space lizard, and I did just say lunar Segway, as in the little two-wheeled bicycle thing, but one equipped for the moon. Another title from Chuck Tingle, Gay T-Rex Law Firm Executive Boner, which is illustrated on the cover by a similar generic shirtless American hunk, and in the background, the aforementioned group of Tyrannosaurus Rex lawyers in their suits sitting around a conference table laughing. Good title, that Gay T-Rex Law Firm Executive Boner. And the third title that Miktar showed in the tweet was Taken by the Gay Unicorn Biker. It's a bit more rough trade, a bit more leather involved in that one, not quite so shirtless. I thought they were pretty good, but the very same morning, Sarah Churchwell tweeted that she was looking for the text of an Abraham Lincoln speech, and the gods of Google gave me this, Who Says Literature is Dead? And what the gods of Google gave Sarah Churchwell is a book by Catherine DeVore, with the truly remarkable, basically it's part of a series, it's actually Presidential Fuck Machine Book 3, and the title is Abraham Lincoln, Fucklord of the Moon. I mean, that takes some beating, and I suppose I really should have taken the effort to look up the titles of Presidential Fuck Machine Books 1 and 2, but quite frankly, Abraham Lincoln, Fucklord of the Moon. I mean, Fucklord of the Moon is a title we should all aspire to. Isn't it? No, that's not a Gay T-Rex Law Firm Executive Boner kind of critter. It's elephant stamp time. Each episode of this podcast, I give an elephant stamp of approval to people who have been exceptional in the category of thinking. And this one's from a few weeks ago, but I think it's pretty special. This is Donald Oprey of Saratoga, somewhere in the United States of America. And this comes via the Twitter account of Adam Samuel, who there's links on the website, as usual. But Donald Oprey has been putting his mind to the high-profile airline incidents that we've seen with Malaysian Airlines, both MH17 and MH370. And he has posted this comment saying, let's put two and two together for a change. There is the missing MH flight, which he means 370, somewhere in the Indian Ocean. And now this one, by which he means MH17, shot down over Ukraine from the same region. He goes on to say, if two airplanes collided in midair with full fuel tanks, they'd probably annihilate each other. Why isn't anyone looking at the possibility of a midair collision between these two planes? Would explain why they are both missing. Mr. Donald Opry, one, the planes aren't both missing. Just one is missing. The other one is in pieces over the Ukraine and kind of is being reassembled. Two, it's a bit hard for them to have had a mid-air collision when the two incidents were months apart. I don't know how long he seems to think MH370 was in the sky. I mean, airliners do carry spare fuel in case of emergencies. He's got a point. Elephant stamp for Mr. Donald Opry. And if you spot something which is deserving of an elephant stamp of approval for someone who has been truly exceptional in the category of thinking, do let me know. This podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and your subscriptions, and your one-off donations, and your good wishes, and your love, and your frottage. Is this going too far? Probably just your subscriptions and one-off contributions and your love is quite enough. Thank you very much. This episode, I would like to say thank you and welcome to a whole bunch of new subscribers, because it's been a while since the last one and we've had the holiday season. Thanks and welcome to new Triple Shot subscribers, Sam Hickey and GP Moore. Thank you so much, because a Triple Shot subscription is a solid little kick each month. Thank you also to new Cheeky Red subscriber, Justin Warren. Hats off to you, sir. Premium Pint subscribers, Alex Volkanovsky, Hamish Taylor and Michael Cowley. Thank you. New Schooner subscriber, Stuart Young, and also new Flat White subscribers, Lawrence Lawson and Nicholas Fryer. Thank you all. If there are extra things owed to you because of your particular subscription level, we'll sort that out very soon. Thank you very much also to generous one-off donors, Just Judith, Paul Williams, Steve Pratt, and Stuart Young. Yes, Stuart Young again, because he not only subscribed, but kicked in a one-off contribution for Christmas. Thank you, sir, and thank you, everyone. You too can become a subscriber to this podcast. Just go to the Skank Media website, skank.com.au/subscribe. It'll explain it all. Everyone who subscribes through until the end of, extend it to the end of February, right? All summer. The summer scrounge will go all summer. Everyone who subscribes through until the end of February will get a free copy of an ebook collection of my writing on surveillance and politics and the Five Eyes stuff in the year and a half or so since Mr. Edward Snowden started his revelations. Some of you will have seen a preview of that ebook a few months back. This will be the updated version with everything through until right now. Everyone who subscribes through till the end of February will get a copy of that ebook. If a subscription is not your thing, and I understand that people may not want to make a continuing contribution, one-off contributions can also be made at the Skank Media website, skank.com.au/tip. Now, I also mentioned that everyone who provides an audio comment between now and the end of February will be in the running for a copy of John Birmingham's book. That's the sound of a book, Emergence. I've got one so far. You can beat this. This is actually a little bit late because it was meant to kind of happen immediately after Christmas, and it makes sense in that context. Nevertheless, I think it holds up after a few weeks. Please listen to the words and wisdom of Mr. Nicholas Fryer.
Christmas, to any sensitive soul, is a difficult time. This is particularly so when one is hosting. and hitherto scattered kin have converged on one's humble dwelling, filling spare rooms with camping mattresses and bathrooms with unfamiliar smells. In such circumstances, privacy becomes a precious commodity. But then, privacy is such a 20th century concept. This year's Christmas presented many of the season's accustomed challenges, including the annual problem of what to do with the leftovers created by my compulsive need to overcater. An attempt had been made on the north face of the ham as early as Christmas Eve. Sustained assaults had been essayed in the following days, rebuffs endured, friendships forged, and morale maintained. But the morning of the 28th saw us, like Napoleon's men after Moscow, numbly contemplating a long retreat, on weary feet, and the everlasting shame of our mothers. The ham had defeated us. Later that morning, I was listening to one of my adorable sons denying any involvement in the breaking of his brother's toy, and musing with John Keats on the relationship between truth and beauty, when suddenly I knew the path I must take. I determined to set off in pursuit of the truth and beauty that I knew lay within, by carving the ham into the likeness of the severed head of the thinking woman's George Clooney, Federal Minister for the Arts and Commonwealth Attorney General, Senator George Brandis QC. The consistency of the ham was perfect. The colour was almost hyper-real. My own spectacles completed the look. As a simulacrum of the Attorney General's head, it wasn't perfect. The ham was boneless. But the similarity was breathtaking. However, over the course of the next 48 hours, it became apparent that I'd merely transformed one problem into another. We started the 28th of December unwilling to eat ham because we'd had too much. We finished the 29th unwilling to eat ham so as not to vandalise a work of art. Senator Brandis's manly beauty is of a fragile kind and would not, we feared, be improved by taking slices off the top of his head, or even nibbling gently on an earlobe. I was then struck by a happy inspiration, and bethought me to enlist the aid of the neighbourhood carnivores, who can usually be relied upon to dispose of any stray sausages or birthday guinea pigs that might be left unattended. Accordingly, with all due ceremony, the senator was carried to the table on the garden deck, and left to fend for himself through the short summer night. However, it appeared that the cats and dogs of our street are all either observant members of one of the stricter Abrahamic faiths, or staunch champions of the rule of law, because the only damage observable in the morning was that the senator was missing his right nostril, pecked off, unless I miss my guess, by a largish bird. Whether the senator's avian assailant was apostate or anarchist could not be determined, but then I've long suspected that kookaburras are secretly a bit of both. And so on the morning of the 30th, I sat on the deck with my laptop, checking my email and, like so many of my fellow Australians, I suppose, searching the internet for nude photographs of prominent scientists. And in a moment of abstraction, looking at, but not really seeing, Senator Brandis's face, my eye was caught by movement. Clearly, sometime in the last few nights, an as yet unidentified but rapidly breeding insect had insinuated its ovipositor into the senator's trembling but pliant flesh, and yielded to a primal hunger, an urge older than our entire species by at least half a billion years. And now, as I watched, the first hatchling larva dropped from the Attorney General's surviving nostril, closely followed by a sibling. I was torn then between alternative courses of action. My first impulse was to fling the head into the compost bin, but my movements were arrested, first by an image of the squirreling, purulent contents of the senator's head bursting over my unprotected hands, but then by a deeper sense of the rightness of the thing, of the work of art not as a static sculpture, but a dynamic one, bursting with new life, and in which I had my own part to play. And so, as the maggots continued to drip from Senator Brandis's nose, and later burst from a hole in his forehead, I turned my laptop so that the screen was clearly visible to the staring, hammy eyes, opened my browsing history, and started to scroll down.
It's fucking art, isn't it? Thank you, Nicholas. Nicholas Fryer there. If you too would like to contribute an audio comment, if you would like to inject your brain into this podcast, there are a number of ways you can do that. If you would like to just use Skype or the telephone, you can Skype to Stilgherrian, or you can phone +612 8011 3733. That will go through to voicemail, where you can leave an audio comment, or you can do what Mr. Fry did. You can do what other people have done just like him in the past and recorded a couple of minutes, a few minutes of wisdom from your brain into my podcast using whatever quality microphone and recording setup you may have at your immediate disposal, and just email it to me. Please do so. You may well find that your contributions end up in the podcast, and you may well find that I consider it the best one I received during the month of February, which will win for you a not too battered copy of John Birmingham's new novel, Emergence, which I quite liked. And I don't think there's too many stains on it. I did kind of read it while eating at one point. There may be a page with some Luxa stains on it. I think that's just noble. Yes, if you want to do an audio comment, Skype to Stilgherrian, our phone, +612 8011 3733, or email me an audio file. Now, I had hoped to bring you a few snippets of wonderful media events that I'd encountered over the last couple of weeks, but I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to finish with one of them. And it relates to the new American movie, American Sniper, directed by Clint Eastwood, which I have not seen yet. And although I kind of want to see it because of the kind of political discussion that's come up around the movie, because, well, it's Clint Eastwood. It's a relatively right-wing, for want of a better word, portrayal of a sniper, and a particular American sniper who is the highest scoring sniper in history as far as we know. And I do want to see it, except I don't want to see it because I know that it will be confronting for a number of personal reasons I choose not to go into at this stage. But what I found absolutely fascinating was that, all right, Michael Moore bought into it and thought that maybe this sort of movie over the Christmas period was not overly appropriate. But what I found truly amazing was a reaction to Michael Moore's comments on Fox News, I mean, where else, by a commentator by the name of Todd Starnes. Here is his entire segment.
I'm Todd Starnes with this American Dispatch. It was another jaw-dropping weekend for American Sniper. More than $200 million in ticket sales, routing the competition and driving liberals bonkers. The New York Times dismissed the massive crowds as Southern and Midwestern. Former DNC Chief Howard Dean called all you folks who saw the movie very angry men, Tea Party types. And consider the latest Twitter tantrum from that tweeting twit Michael Moore. Asking, what would Jesus do? Oh, I know what he'd do. Hide on top of a roof and shoot people in the back. What would Jesus do if he could be a sniper and save soldiers' lives by shooting savages in the back? Well, I'm no theologian, but I suspect Jesus would tell that God-fearing, red-blooded American sniper, well done, thou good and faithful servant, for dispatching another godless jihadist to the lake of fire. But then again, I'm no theologian. There was a time when Hollywood and Democrats stood in solidarity with our fighting men and women, folks like Jimmy Stewart and Bob Hope and John Wayne, American heroes. Those days are long gone, and our sweet land of liberty has been soiled by the stinking stench of Michael Moore and Howard Dean and their liberal minions. I'm Todd Starnes. Be sure to check out my page on foxnews.com for more American dispatches.
Excellent work there, Todd. Particularly like the idea of the godless jihadist. I think you may have missed their point just a little bit. Well done, Todd. Well, that's the edict for now. There's links to some of the things, many of the things I mentioned on the podcast web page, on the internet, on the World Wide Web. You can also leave a comment there. You can type words. Even better, you can leave an audio comment. I did tell you before how to do that, but you Skype to Stilgarian or phone Sydney, +612 8011 3733. Give me your thoughts. The next episode of the 9pm Edict will be whenever the fuck I feel like it. I'm Stilgarian. See you then.
The 9pm Edict is a Skank Media production. Sorry,